We chose the subject wrestling with God. It resonated with me, this wrestling aspect. I wrestled in school, wrestled 3 years in junior high school, 3 years in high school. And you come across a scripture where where this ancient worthy is having this wrestling match with this angel. And you guys go, I got to look into that, see what that's all about. So we are going to look at one of the more dramatic and memorable scenes in the Bible. And that's the all-night wrestling match between Jacob and the angel of God. So we're going to look today at what it might mean to wrestle with God. So we're going to start with Jacob, and then we're going to consider how we might wrestle with God today. So Jacob's story begins in chapter 25 of Genesis with the birth of not one son, but two. Jacob and Esau are fraternal twins who seem destined for conflict from birth. Jacob, who was the second son, has got a hold of Esau's heel as he is born into this world. And appropriately, the meaning of Jacob's name is taking hold of the heel, supplanter, layer of snares. Fast forward many years. The boys have grown to manhood. Esau sells his birthright to Jacob, probably thinking he can get out of it later. Some more time passes, and Isaac is pretty much blind and apparently a little bit senile. He calls Esau, wanting to give him the firstborn blessing before he dies. Now, this would be a good time for Esau to tell his dad that he sold his birthright to Jacob for some lunch. But he conveniently forgets to do this. Esau, the mighty man of the fields, goes out to hunt down a meal and bring it back to Isaac, hoping he can sneak in a blessing without Jacob finding out about it. Esau, it seems, had every intention of breaking the oath he swore to Jacob concerning the birthright. Now, Rebekah just happens to overhear this meal deal between Isaac and Esau. But instead of calling for a family meeting to get all the facts out in the open, she devises a plan that does not involve telling the truth. Jacob carries out that plan, the central part of which includes him deceiving and lying to his old father to secure the birthright blessing for himself. It works. Esau comes back right after this, and he is livid about not getting the birthright blessing. Even though the birthright was not technically his by nature of the stew deal, Esau feels cheated, and he makes it clear that his little brother is a dead man as soon as Isaac dies. So, to protect her boy Jacob, Rebekah tells Isaac a sort of half-truth, saying she wants Jacob to go to Haran, where her brother Laban lives, not to get away from Esau, but to find a wife. So, Jacob's journey begins. He gives up his life as a homebody, and he flees from his hairy and scary brother. And he takes refuge with his uncle Laban, where he marries Rachel. But not before Laban tricks him into marrying her older, weak-eyed sister, Leah, first. Jacob winds up begetting 7 children by Leah, 6 boys and a girl. Rachel gets jealous of all the babies Leah is having and gives her handmaid Bilhah to Jacob, who bears him 2 boys. At this point, Leah can't seem to have any more children, so she gives her handmaid Zilpah to Jacob, who bears him 2 more boys. And then Rachel finally has a son of her own, Joseph, and later she will die giving birth to her 2nd child, Benjamin. What a mess. From the beginning of Jacob's story and through all the shady dealings, we have 12 sons. The nation of Israel is born out of what might reasonably be called family dysfunction, which we will see will be with them throughout their entire existence, sort of like the rest of us and our families, I would imagine. Now, there's no making excuses for any of them. Reading the Jacob story for the moral virtues of the main characters, like you might read a kid's fairy tale, is misreading the story. The heroes are not all good, and the villains are not all bad. Like life, it's complicated. Getting back to the story, Jacob decides he spent quite enough time with his shady father-in-law slash uncle, but Laban realizes the good thing he has going and the blessings he's gotten from Jacob's presence, and he doesn't want Jacob to go. So they work out a deal where Jacob agrees to stay and take care of Laban's flocks and herds under one condition. Laban must allow Jacob to keep all the speckled, spotted, and dark animals that are born. Now, it must have seemed to Laban that his son-in-law had lost a step and that he was getting the better part of this deal. But it turns out that Jacob was not, or he was a lot quicker than Laban had given him credit for. And now it's Laban's turn to fall for some sort of a trick, a sort of thing involving an odd animal mating ritual of some kind. And once again, Jacob profits by laying a snare, as his name suggests. And all the healthy animal babies end up belonging to Jacob, while the weaklings go to Laban. Laban becomes suspicious and a bit moody towards Jacob, and Jacob does what he does best. He avoids conflict, and he takes off towards his ancestral homeland in Canaan. But Laban chases after him. Laban's main beef wasn't that he felt cheated, though he did. It was because someone had stolen his household gods, which was apparently a big deal. It turns out Rachel took them. When Laban catches up to Jacob to confront him about the gods, it seems Rachel is also a bit of a trickster, like her father and her husband. While Laban is searching a tent, Rachel takes the gods and puts them in her saddle and sits on them. When Laban comes over to her, she politely says, "I would love to get down and give you a big hug, Dad, but unfortunately, I have a bit of a womanly situation." Crisis averted, and Jacob and Laban agree to part in peace. And with this, Jacob's 20-year relationship with Laban comes to an end. And this brings us to Genesis chapter 32, and we'll spend the rest of our time in. And Jacob's all-night wrestling match with God before his reunion with Esau. Genesis 32, and we're going to pretty much read the whole chapter bit by bit, starting in verses 1 and 2. And Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's host." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. Chapter 32 is about encounters of one kind or another. When Jacob returns to Canaan, he is met by angels. This seems to form a kind of symmetry between Jacob's departure from Canaan many years ago, when he had the dream of the angels at Bethel going up and down the ladder, and now on his return trip, he encounters an encampment of angels. The Hebrew word for host in verse 2 is Mahane, Strong's number 4264. It means encampment. Jacob names the place Mahanaim, the same as encampment, but in the plural. So it means twin camps or two camps. Now, what exactly these camps of angels are doing, we're not told. I favor the thought that they were military camps, giving off a warlike vibe, but with the friendly intent of giving a warning to Jacob of an upcoming hostile environment. And as we will see, that warning is confirmed when Jacob learned that Esau was on his way with a host of 400 men. Genesis 32, verses 3 to 6. And Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, unto the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commended them, saying, "Thus shall you speak unto my lord Esau, thy servant Jacob saith thus, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now. And I have oxen and asses, flocks and men servants and women servants. And I have sent to tell my Lord that I might find grace in thy sight." And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to thy brother Esau, and also he cometh to meet thee, and 400 men with him." So Jacob sends messengers to tell Esau he's coming back with his family and his servants and all his stuff. So I hope we're good. And there's no hard feelings or anything about the whole birthright thing. I come in peace. Let's have a family reunion, not a battle. And by the way, just because I've lived with old Laban for a while, don't think I've learned any of his bad ways. But Jacob did, in fact, learn from Laban. The deceiver met another deceiver, and he learned how it feels to receive an injustice and not just dish it out. He learned that it hurt, and it was a necessary step in his development as a man, and it helped bring about the honorable way he behaved toward Esau on his return. In verse 6, Jacob's messengers report that Esau is on his way with 400 men. It looks like Esau has revenge on his mind, and he's brought an army to help him get it. Verses 7 and 8, Genesis 32. Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that was with him, and the flocks, and the herds, and the camels, into two bands. And he said, "If Esau come to one company and smite it, then the other company which is left shall escape." Well, Jacob, he's in pretty much in a panic mode now. After 20 years, he comes down home, knowing he'd have to face Esau sooner or later. And it's come down to this, a potential battle for survival. And so what happens is Jacob divides his servants and his flocks and herds into two companies so that if one group were attacked, the other might be able to run away and escape. He sends them all on ahead while he stays behind with his immediate family, and he prays to God that Esau doesn't kill them all. Verses 9 through 12, Genesis 32. And Jacob said, "O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, the Lord which saith unto me, Return unto thy country and to thy kindred, and I will deal well with thee. I'm not worthy of the least of all the mercies and all the truth which thou hast shown unto thy servant. For with my staff I passed over this Jordan, and now I am become two bands. Deliver me, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. And thou sayest, I will surely do thee good, and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude." Jacob is basically reminding God of the promises he made at Bethel when Jacob first left Canaan. Those promises included land and posterity, too great to number. And so Jacob reminds God in prayer, the gist of which is, if you're going to honor these promises, you have to save me and my family now. Amen. Now, verses 13 to 23, which we're not going to read, tell us how, over the next 2 days, Jacob carried out his plan to appease his brother and avoid a bloody confrontation by sending presents, one after another, in the form of livestock to Esau. And so, after these few days, Jacob had gotten all his substance, as well as all his family, transported over the brook Jabbok, and he alone remained behind for the night. Verses 24 to 30, or 24 to 32 of Genesis 34 reads, "And Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled the man with him until the breaking of the day. And when he saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. And he said, Let me go, for the day breaketh. And he said, I will not let thee go, except thou bless me. And he said unto him, What is thy name? And he said, Jacob. And he said, Thy name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince thou hast power with God and with men, and hast prevailed. And Jacob asked him and said, Tell me, I pray thee, thy name. And he said, Wherefore is it that thou dost ask after my name? And he blessed him there. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. And as he passed over Penuel, the sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. Therefore, the children of Israel eat not the sinew which shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh unto this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh in the sinew that shrank. And so we finally come to the heart of the matter, the wrestling with God. When you think about it, this image of wrestling has been a major part of Jacob's life. He was wrestling as he emerged from the womb, grabbing Esau's heel. Later in life, he figuratively wrestled with Esau as he strove for the birthright. When he first met Rachel, he wrestled the stone away from the mouth of the well. For 20 years, he figuratively wrestled with Laban for his family and his possessions. And now, in the culminating moment of his life, when he is returning to the land of promise, he is wrestling with God. So it seems as Jacob was on the doorstep of entering the promised land, when he is seriously questioning if he and his seed will survive to inherit the birthright blessings because his brother, his bitter rival for the birthright, is coming to destroy him. Before he can enter the land and claim the promises, he first has to wrestle God. What are we supposed to make of this? Why this wrestling match, and why now? In this literal wrestling match with a man, Jacob seems to be symbolically completing what he has been engaged in from his mother's womb, his striving for the birthright, the possession of the covenant promises and the covenant blessings. It all seemed to come down to the outcome of this wrestling match. If he could survive this, he surely could survive the encounter with his brother. So, all alone in the dark of the night, before the morning, when Jacob will be reconciled with Esau, a man appears and starts wrestling with Jacob. This is very unusual. It's not exactly the first thing that you think when you meet up with a total stranger. You're not really sure who this man is at first, but by the end of the story, it's pretty clear he's wrestling with God, or an angel, a messenger of God. This wrestling match seems to represent everything Jacob has had to contend with concerning the birthright, not only externally, but internally as well. All that Jacob had to wrestle with within himself, all his hopes, fears about his worthiness to inherit the birthright. This wrestling match seemed to be a test of Jacob's fitness to be the heir of the covenant, much like how Abraham was tested when he was asked to offer up Isaac in sacrifice to God. And the results of this test were very encouraging. Though he was left alone to wrestle through the night with a mysterious opponent, Jacob did not falter and he did not quit. He hung in there, giving as good as he got, hold for hold, move for move. And when you think about it, this is pretty much what we would expect from Jacob, because up to this point, in all of his dealings, Jacob, the bargainer, the heel grabber, has always managed to win out. And it seems like he has a pretty good shot of winning against this mysterious stranger, in that he has at least wrestled him to a tie. But God decides the struggle has been going on long enough. And he takes Jacob and he touches him on the hip, putting it out of joint, because this wrestling match has been going on all night, and God has had enough. At this point, as his leg is probably hanging by a thread, Jacob realizes for sure that this is no ordinary man that he's wrestling. No normal opponent could put his hip out of joint by simply touching it. He's badly injured, and he's probably in a lot of pain. But he still won't let go, because he has put too much effort into this, and he wants something from his wrestling opponent. And he wants it bad. He wants a blessing. In fact, even though he's in no position to make demands, Jacob demands a blessing, or he won't let go. Now, I don't know about you, but doesn't it seem a bit unusual to demand a blessing from someone that you've been fighting with? But Jacob sensed this was his golden opportunity, and he wasn't about to let it go. Now, I don't know exactly what Jacob had in mind for his blessing, but it was probably along the lines of assurances that he would survive the upcoming encounter with Esau and live to inherit the Abrahamic covenant. That would have been a real nice blessing. But God had something entirely different in mind. God basically said, "Okay, you want a blessing, Jacob? I'll give you a blessing. You shall no longer be called Jacob. You're going to get a name change. You're going to be called Israel, for you have striven with God and with humans." So his blessing is that his name change from Jacob to Israel, which is where the name Israel comes from. Why Israel? What does Israel even mean? The Hebrew word Israel means striving with God. That's what the word means. Isra means sort of striving, and El means God. Now, there's others in the scholarly world who say that Israel means one who strives or prevails with God. Still others say it means prince of God. Others, one who wrestles or struggles with God. Now, all of these definitions, I don't know about the prince of God, but these others, can be found in Jacob's experiences of wrestling with God. So I am going to be focusing on the definition, one who strives or struggles with God, which seems to commemorate the event that gave rise to this name change. And so we have this situation where God visits Jacob at a time when everything Jacob holds dear is in the balance between life and death. And the next minute, they're having this epic all-night wrestling match. And God started it. And Jacob's blessing at the end of the match is a new name that means striving with God. And baked into this new name, Israel, is this divinely initiated wrestling match that leads to this blessing, a blessing that seems to say, at least for Jacob or Israel, that it is a blessing to strive with God. No one else gets to wrestle God, but you do. That's your blessing. And when you think about it, striving or wrestling or struggling with God is baked into Israel's very existence. We see it everywhere. Israel wrestled at times with their faith in God, starting with their journey in the wilderness after the Exodus. They had their doubts about how things were going. Israel's epic story contains some pretty fierce doubt as a part of their experience as God's people. More than once, they wanted to give up and go back to their old life of slavery in Egypt. The Bible is not sanitized. Although the decisions the Israelites made when they struggled with God were sometimes the wrong decisions, the Bible doesn't treat these isolated periods of struggling with God in and of itself as something that is wrong or sinful or something to be ashamed of. The striving is treated as an infrequent but central part of their journey of faith. Take the book of Psalms, for instance. The Psalms have a reputation for being uplifting, and they are. Jews and Christians alike have gotten a lot of solace and encouragement from them over the centuries. Most of the Psalms say something like this. They say, everything is fine. God is with us. Everything is going as God planned. We are a blessed people. Stay the course. But some of the Psalms bend this mold. These Psalms point out that everything is not fine. In fact, things are terribly wrong, and I'm at the end of my rope. I don't see how this can possibly end well. But the Lord has rescued me in the past, and I know he will be coming to rescue me this time, if not sooner than later. But there are a very few Psalms that not only bend the mold, they break the mold. They reflect real struggling and striving with God, where the psalmist says things are terribly wrong. I'm at the end of my rope. And to make matters worse, oh Lord, you are nowhere to be found. One such psalm is Psalm 88. Let me just summarize it for you. Oh Lord, I've been on my knees to you night after night. I am so troubled and in so much agony. I feel like I have one foot in the grave. I'm in a dark place. I am absolutely without hope, including in you. You really don't seem to care. Actually, let me be even more blunt. You've abandoned me, and this is all your fault. You're the one who makes me feel like this. But even so, all night and all day, I'm on my knees praying, still calling to you for some relief. Can't you see how desperate I am? But you keep on hiding. I'm in absolute pain, and the only friend I have is darkness. Thanks for nothing. The writer of this psalm is really wrestling with his relationship and his understanding of God. It's hard to imagine anyone actually talking like this in one of our meetings or giving such a testimony. Even if someone feels this way, letting your guard down and bearing your soul with this degree of raw honesty is risky. The brethren might think, what is wrong with this brother or sister? What weak faith. We better set up some sort of emergency intervention so that this negative attitude doesn't affect the rest of us. And so it's really no wonder that we don't hear this level of honest struggle voiced by the brethren. Do you ever wonder why the ancient Israelites not only wrote things like Psalm 88 in the first place, but then kept them forever in this most sacred book? Are they only there as examples of what not to do? Of what a true Israelite would never think or say? I don't think so. Thoughts like these in Psalm 88 are sometimes a part of what it means to be Israel, to struggle with God. Sometimes feeling like God is far away, not interested, or even dead to you is part of our Bible. It's there for a reason, and it can't just be brushed aside. And when an Israelite wrestles with God like this, no matter how intense it may be, and even offensive as it may seem, it is never judged. It is never shamed. It is never criticized by God. God never promised or intended Israel's or our Christian experience to be free from struggle. So why would he look down on us when we struggle, even if we struggle with God? But if the result of the striving leads to no longer trusting God or in flat-out disobedience, that is always criticized. Worshiping other gods or acting unjustly toward others gets criticized every time. But not this honest talk about feeling confused or even abandoned by God, as long as you are still trusting God where you cannot trace him. Let's not forget that Jesus himself experienced God's abandonment on the cross, though he never lost his trust. And he used a ready and waiting psalm to express his feelings. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Like with Jesus, though not nearly as profound, the feeling of abandonment in some form happens to all of us. It's probably a lot more common among us than we feel comfortable admitting. These experiences and feelings of doubt or fear or confusion or abandonment, these wrestlings with God that we find in Job and Ecclesiastes and a few of the Psalms, are not evidences that something has gone terribly wrong with these individual people and then it needs to be fixed. On the contrary, these wrestlings are the very real experiences of people of faith. And they are in the Bible because these experiences were reflective of the experiences of many other people of faith. They are and were a part of the struggling with God, of being Israel, and they are to be valued as a blessing. Wrestling with God is not only what happened in the life of faith of ancient Israel, but it is also what does happen and what we should expect to happen with us, spiritual Israel. This is not to say that our entire Christian life is lived in a constant state of wrestling with God. No one could live in a constant state of insecurity where we're no longer sure about God or anything else for that matter. We just couldn't function or live if this is how we had to do it. We are thankful for that. For the most part, we live lives of secure faith, where we are absolutely confident in the things we believe and where things are working out as God tells us they would. But there will be those rare times and seasons where we do wrestle with God. And the reason it is a blessing is this. Sometimes you need to change. I think when you wrestle with God, you change, and you're never really the same again. As an example, I can't go back to the time many years ago as a young Christian. I wanted to love and trust God, but I wrestled with him whether I honestly could, because I was raised to believe in hell. I wrestled with God over why he would condemn anyone to the eternal flames. And that wrestling experience started me on the path to the truth. It changed me. Wrestling changes you. I can never go back to before that time when I wrestled with God about putting people in hell. I could never believe in hell again, and my understanding of God has permanently changed. Now, I don't think I'm the only one here who's had some kind of life-changing and faith-altering experience. Our experiences are all different. I'm not talking about that. They may be big, and they also may be small. But many of us have experienced such moments. I'm talking about those moments when we say, what has always worked for me before is no longer working, or what I used to think of as absolutely true now seems to be a little shaky. It is times like these that God may be speaking to us. God may be challenging us to a wrestling match like he did Jacob. So these moments, these experiences we have that make us say, huh, I never thought of it that way. I've always thought of it this way. These might be the moments where we're invited, sometimes kicking and screaming, to a wrestling match that will change us. So here's what wrestling does. It opens our minds and our hearts to go beyond where we are right now. Wrestling, struggling with anything, including God, is a necessary part of growth. There's an expression we're all familiar with, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. And it's mostly through adversity that we learn the most and grow. Where do we think the term growing pains comes from? Why do we think the scriptures tell us we have to suffer with Christ in order to grow into him? Growth means not staying the same. We don't grow while we're on cruise control. And we're all comfortable and think that we know everything, so we can't possibly change. We grow when we're challenged to wrestle, to strive with God over something concerning our life of faith. How many of us believe the exact same way today as we did 10, 20, 30, even 50 years ago? About society, about politics, about our relationships, about life in general, about how best to live a life of that reflects our faith. Did those changes come easy, or did you wrestle over them? Living a life where you are willing to wrestle, willing to struggle, willing to change or consider looking at things from a different perspective, when it seems God is inviting us, can be very hard, because change is hard. These times when the things that we thought we knew, when things that we could be so certain of and count on, when these things turn out to be not so certain at all, during these times, our first thought might be to automatically think we're doing something wrong because we've allowed these seeds of doubt to creep in. You might think, it's all my fault. My faith is weak. God must be so disappointed in me. But don't let that stop you, because it might be a totally wrong thought. It might actually be an invitation to enter into a wrestling match initiated by God that will lead to a positive change. Now, this is part of the struggle. But at times like these, remember that God cares enough about our struggles in trying to lead a life of faith that he weaves the idea of struggle so strongly into the fabric of Scripture. And like God instigated the wrestling match with Jacob in order to bless him, we too are sometimes invited to wrestle with God in the hope that we will be changed and grow and be blessed by the experience. Jacob wrestled all through the dark night, just him and God. I'm sure it wasn't a fake big-time wrestling match either. It was hard fought. It was intense. It was exhausting. It wasn't easy, and it wasn't fun. It wasn't until the morning of a new day that he got the blessing. But the struggle cost him. He was never the same man. You could tell by the way he walked. Let us pray that our struggles in the narrow way will change us also, and that we will be able to tell that the Lord has blessed us because we walk differently, that we walk with more faith and more trust in God and in his love for us, even if it causes us to limp a little. May the Lord add his blessing.